You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 12th of May 2014 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Steve Bloomfield. Coming up on today's programme... A video emerges apparently showing more than 200 schoolgirls kidnapped by Nigeria's Boko Haram rebel group last month, as international pressure to rescue the schoolchildren grows.
Like millions of people across the globe, my husband and I are outraged and heartbroken over the kidnapping of more than 200 Nigerian girls from their school dormitory in the middle of the night.
Michelle Obama there in a plea for the girls' release. I'll be joined by Xenia Dormandy, US Project Director at Chatham House, and Ivor Gaber from City University to discuss that and the rest of the day's news. Also ahead, we'll hear from the author David Sachs on how exactly to create a foodie fad.
Some individual working in their kitchen creates something, and that thing resonates with eaters, but also with the media, and it moves down the food chain until suddenly, a couple years later, you're eating, you know, sriracha-flavored Doritos.
All that, plus we'll ask why this...
Next country is... Russia! La Russie!
Was the reaction to Russia's entry at Saturday night's Eurovision Song Contest in Copenhagen. All that and plenty more, including perhaps a bit of music, all here on Midori House with me, Steve Bloomfield. As ever, a lot to fit in over the next 60 minutes. And first, here's Suzanne Chislett with the latest news headlines for around the world.
Monocle 24 News, I'm Suzanne Chislett. Russia's foreign ministry says the authorities in Kiev are showing a criminal lack of readiness for dialogue with separatists in the east of Ukraine. It's the first comment from Moscow since leaders in the region of Donetsk called on the Kremlin to consider absorbing it following Sunday's self-rule referendums. The European Union has again criticised the ballots, which Kiev said were illegal. At a meeting of foreign ministers from the 28-nation bloc in Brussels, the EU announced more sanctions against two companies in Crimea and senior Russian and Ukrainian figures in response to the unrest. The Islamist militants who kidnapped more than 200 schoolgirls in Nigeria last month have released a video apparently showing more than half of them alive and well. The girls are dressed in full Muslim dress, and Boko Haram's leader, Abu Bakr Shekau, claims they've converted to Islam. He says they will only be released in exchange for all imprisoned militants. Israel has become the latest nation to offer expertise in the search for the students. Gadir Simon is one of those who managed to escape.
The time that this thing happened to us, we are in the school, so we are sleeping in the room, and we are hearing the gun. So that we come out and we sit in outside, so that we are sitting and all the staff they run and they leave us in the school.
Aviation officials from the United Nations and around 40 countries are in Montreal for the highest level safety talks yet in response to the disappearance of Malaysia Airlines flight MH370. 329 people were on board the Boeing 777, which is believed to have gone down in the southern Indian Ocean. No trace of it has been found. The two-day meeting in Canada comes after the British satellite firm, which helped track the final known movements of the flight, offered to allow all planes fitted with its Inmarsat technology a free tracking service. It would see GPS heading, speed and altitude information automatically stored every 15 minutes. The Italian Navy says around 200 people have been rescued after a boat carrying migrants between Libya and Italy sank. 14 people drowned when the vessel capsized near the island of Lampedusa. In Afghanistan, Taliban militants have launched a pre-declared summer offensive across the country. It comes as international combat troops continue preparations to leave later this year. In a report out today, the think tank, the International Crisis Group, forecasts a violent future for Afghanistan, saying the number of Islamist insurgent attacks increased by 15 to 20% in 2013 from a year earlier. India's marathon election is over, though the results won't be known for several more days. The ballots, which saw more than 800 million people be eligible to have their say in who should sit in the country's parliament, has taken 5 weeks to run. The final polls have now closed, though the votes won't be counted until May the 16th. The Washington Monument has reopened 3 years after it was damaged by a 5.8 magnitude earthquake. The 170-metre-tall marble and granite obelisk suffered cracks and loosened stones in the tremor. The US Congress appropriated $7.5 million to repair the damage, an amount matched by billionaire philanthropist David Rubenstein.
I really just wanted to say two things. One, I only did what other Americans who have the good fortune that I have had would have done, presented with the same opportunity. Many Americans have had good fortune. I have had good fortune. And I really wanted to give back to the country. And this was just a down payment on my obligation to repay the country for what it has done for me and for my family.
That's the American philanthropist David Rubenstein. And that's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Suzanne Chislett, thank you very much indeed. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Това е Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo. Dette er Monocle 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Tokyost. See on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo, Monocle 24 desu.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. It's 18:07 here in London. It's 13:07 in New York City. Joining me now with their take on the day's news is Zania Dormandy and Ivor Gaber. Welcome to you both. We're going to start in Nigeria. A little earlier today, a new video emerged, apparently posted by the Boko Haram militant group, that appears to show the 200 or so schoolgirls kidnapped by the group almost a month ago. That was part of the video that was released. Among the developments also today are that alongside the US, Britain and France, who've already offered assistance, now Israel is promising help too. Ivor Gaber, if I can come to you first, the release of that video and then obviously Israel promising help as well, what do you make of where we are right now, almost a month on and since this first began?
Well, we're a month on and the situation, if anything, is more complicated than it was when they first took the girls, an event that everybody has noticed now was not noticed, which was one of the issues that needs to be considered. I think the involvement of Israel might make a lot of sense logistically or tactically, but it is a touch of red rags to the bull when you think you've got militant Islamicists here. Israel is not exactly their favourite country. However, the backdrop to all of this is the very deep division between the north of Nigeria, which is mainly Islamic, and the south, which is mainly Christian. And we're coming up to a presidential election, and there's a lot of history, which I won't go into, but the north has felt alienated from the south and has therefore been, to some extent, sympathetic to Boko Haram, just like the IRA could only operate because there was sympathy for them amongst the Catholic community. Boko Haram have been able to operate because of that sympathy, although whether that will continue after the current kidnapping is an interesting question.
Although, Zania, you're also talking about part of Nigeria where law and order has, to a large extent, broken down over the past few years. Governance, in all forms in Nigeria, whether we talk about a free press, whether we talk about the rule of law, justice, free and fair elections, often doesn't exist.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And you know, we shouldn't expect the same kind of governance and security as we see it being able to take place in Nigeria. They have huge economic challenges that they're facing, social challenges that they're facing. And of course, you have to remember, it's not just the Boko Haram. If you go down to the south, you've got militants in the Delta. You've got huge amounts of corruption, not least in terms of oil flows. But you also, I mean, you know, again, this is one of those complicating factors. You also have incredible entrepreneurship. When I was last there, I mean, the level of energy and potential, human potential that's in the country is enormous. But they don't have the kind of institutional or governing structures that can channel that in an effective way. And so this is it's a very, very complex challenge, and it's a huge political challenge for Jonathan Goodluck.
And indeed, you know, Ivor, when we talk about, you know, the problems that Goodluck Jonathan has, it's, you know, just 2 months ago, we had, you know, the story that was coming out of Nigeria, and again, these stories are only ever 2D, was incredibly positive because they'd rejigged their GDP, and now all of a sudden Nigeria was far wealthier than we thought.
Well, yes, up to a point. We've always known Nigeria is very wealthy, but we also know it has the largest number of people living below the poverty line of any African country. The wealth in Nigeria, as Zain has just said, is incredibly distorted. But it is also, as she says, an incredibly entrepreneurial country. I've been working in Nigeria until a year ago. As soon as there's a traffic jam, and let me tell you, there are many, 1,000 people turn up and start selling things to the traffic. And people who say Africans don't have the entrepreneurial spirit only have to spend 5 minutes in a traffic jam in Lagos to know that's not quite right.
Well, basically, anyone who starts a sentence with "Africans are" is an idiot anyway. So I want to, Zenia, I want to bring you back in this a moment. But before we do, I want to just move us on a little bit and talk a bit about hashtag activism, because we've seen this a lot with the situation in Nigeria, and this hashtag bring back our girls. Before we come on to talk about that, here's a bit of what Michelle Obama had to say at the weekend when she stepped in for her husband to give the weekly presidential address.
Like millions of people across the globe, my husband and I are outraged and heartbroken over the kidnapping of more than 200 Nigerian girls from their school dormitory in the middle of the night. This unconscionable act was committed by a terrorist group determined to keep these girls from getting an education. Grown men attempting to snuff out the aspirations of young girls. And I want you to know that Barack has directed our government to do everything possible to support the Nigerian government's efforts to find these girls and bring them home.
To do everything possible there, Zainia Dormandy. That's what she said, with a slight caveat following that. I feel slightly conflicted about these hashtags, because in a way this was a campaign that started inside Nigeria, that it was an expression of Nigerians saying, you know, protesting against their government. And yet it's become something else the further away from Nigeria you get. And there's something a little bit uncomfortable about Michelle Obama, or we also saw over the weekend David Cameron holding up a piece of card with a hashtag saying bring back our girls. It's like, well, who are you saying that to? And a terrorist group isn't going to look at a piece of card and go, oh right, yeah, all right, we'll do that.
No, but others will. I mean, I have to say, I mean, it's if, you know, if tweeting is a substitute for action, then I understand people's concern. You know, the idea that people will choose to tweet rather than to do something more active, to do something more reactive. If tweeting is something that actually gathers support that then comes together to actually persuade people to act in concrete ways, then presumably that's a good thing, if those concrete ways are positive. So to me, this is one more vehicle of pressure. And it may not be, as you rightly point out, Steve, this may not be pressure actually against Boko Haram, because frankly, they're not reading it, most likely. But this may be pressure against other entities, not least the Nigerian government or others in the region, to actually take action, the AU, in a more productive way. So I think it depends whether it's a substitute or whether it's another form of pressure.
Ivor Gaver.
I agree with you. I think you're wrong to suggest that Boko Haram won't read them. My experience as a journalist with terrorist and guerrilla groups is they are very au fait with social media. I think it would have played a tiny part, but I'm sure it motivated Goodluck Jonathan to go on the television and at last show some interest in the fact that 300 of his girls had been kidnapped. So it has some effect. I'm not against it, but I would caution. I think we will all remember the Kony 2012 campaign, huge social media campaign to allege, to try and get the leader of the Lord's Resistance Army in Uganda brought to justice. And it has come to nothing.
It's part of the problem, though, with that. That was an evangelical filmmaker from California, not, you know, thousands upon thousands of Ugandans saying something needs to be done.
But it did attract hundreds of thousands, if not millions of followers. I can't tell you the figure. Mm. And it was pointless. And it did damage to, if you like, online campaigning.
But did it actually do damage? I mean, this is where I kind of get caught up. We don't like the idea of it being personalised, you know, of it being taken out of the region. It's no longer Ugandans or it's no longer Nigerians, it's Americans or it's British or whatever. But to me, if you're coming up with a strategy to create action, to create effort, then wouldn't you use all tools in that strategy?
But surely the issue here is, what action? Because what certainly happened here is that catch-all phrase of we've raised awareness. Awareness around the world has been raised. But what happens if Boko Haram say, yeah, we're not going to bring back your girls?
Or, as they have said, we'll bring them back if you release all our prisoners.
What happens next? Are we going to go and get them back?
But again, my question is, you know, take a step back. America gets criticized for being too proactive, for being too militaristic, for being too, you know, use of hard power. But then when America doesn't act, America gets criticized for doing nothing. Now, you can argue that this is somewhere in between. You've got not the American state, but you've got American people saying, our hearts are with you, we care, we want to put pressure on governments, we want to create that impetus for action. And they get blamed for doing this. So, I mean, my question, you know, comes down to, well, what do you want Americans or Westerners to do? You don't want them to use hard power. That's clear. You don't want them to do nothing. That's clear. You don't want them to do that. What do you? And the answer is there isn't one answer. Everybody thinks something different. But
it's part of the problem here that, you know, yes, we've raised awareness. But then, Ivor Gaber, what is the course of action? There doesn't seem to be anything that anyone's gathering around saying, well, right, we need to do this.
I think there's the short term and the medium term. The short term is obviously every decent thinking person, what a terrible phrase, but you know what I mean, wants to see those girls rescued and what almost whatever it takes. In the medium term, I will hazard two positives that might come out of, and raising awareness is not a bad thing in itself, but what will it lead to? Firstly, I think it will make the Nigerian government far more proactive in dealing with Boko Haram, because as we understand it, the army who's there in large numbers weren't even in that town when they were tipped off that Boko Haram was about to come. So I think it might have a positive effect there, and I think it will also have a positive effect on those countries, Islamic countries, which give tacit support and shelter to Boko Haram and alike.
Sorry to make things even more complex or highlight more complexity, but when you say, Ivor, about, you know, it put a bit of pressure on the Nigerian armed forces, these are the same security forces that have been criticised themselves by Human Rights Watch a couple of years ago, by Amnesty as well, for committing human rights abuses themselves.
Absolutely. And that's one of the problems. But if they know that the world spotlight, such as it is now on them, I would hope that might moderate their behaviour.
Ivor Gaber, Xenia Dormandy, we'll leave it there. When we come back, we'll be talking Ukraine, Russia, possibly even Eurovision, if you're very, very lucky. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
Global affairs, culture, business, design or urbanism. At Monocle 24, we've got it covered. And when it comes to transport and travel, you need look no further. From automobile innovators to the creative minds shaping the in-flight experience, we speak to the experts to ensure you have all the industry news you'll ever need. In New York, our transport editor, Tristan McAllister.
Whether it's a closer look at the global aviation heavyweights or embedding with the people who keep Alaska's state ferry system afloat, we take you to the people and the places that make our world move.
Take to the skies, the rails, the seas or the roads with Monocle 24, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
You're back with Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Steve Bloomfield. Still with me is Xenia Dormandy and Ivor Gaber. Two referendums held in eastern Ukraine over the weekend have been described as illegal by the country's interim Prime Minister, Oleksandr Tikhonov. Well, the results still haven't been announced, but how legitimate will a popular decision to break from Kiev be? Xenia Dormandy, we think it's going to be around 80-odd% saying yes. They've claimed that the turnout was a massive 75%, though how they've claimed that, we don't know. It's what do you think of when you look at a referendum? Is there anything that this can tell us other than Ukraine still has many, many problems?
I mean, the problem is, yes, no question, Ukraine still has many, many problems. But actually, the problems are getting worse. Because now what you have is you have a referendum that the people who believe in the referendum or believe in the results of the referendum, i.e., either independence or certainly a split from Ukraine, will take that as a legitimizing factor, that the majority clearly want a split from Ukraine and therefore their efforts are awarded and they should move. And you'll have the other side, the people who hold the other position, who look at it and say, that clearly wasn't legitimate. How do you hold a credible referendum when you've got instability, when you have two factions effectively warring, and in cases warring, literally warring against one another? And essentially what you're doing is you're polarizing the two sides. And so you've now got two even more polarized sides with what they believe are yet more facts to support their position. And what you need in order to resolve this in some form or another is actually changing the narrative, finding common ground that they can come together. And it's the opposite that's happening at the moment.
I think it's even more, I think there's a double polarisation, because I'm not sure that in a free and fair referendum there would be an overwhelming majority for linking up with Russia. In Ukraine, there is a very strong memory, a bitter memory, of how under the Soviet system, Ukraine was exploited. We talked, there was mass famines, obviously that's going back to the 40s. But there's not deep and profound love by all Ukrainians in the East. And I think Ukraine in the East, in a free and fair referendum, it would be a close call.
Well, just picking up on that, I mean, the Pew Research Center released polling this month that indicated that 70% of respondents in eastern Ukraine favored keeping the country united. Only 18% favored secession. So, you know, as you say, if it was free and fair, we might find almost the opposite result coming out.
I've been staggered from the beginning of this about how bad Ukraine's politicians are. When you look at the...
They say the same about ours, by the way. But
I'm sure they do. I'm sure they do on their free and fair media in eastern Ukraine. But in the sense that, you know, where has Vitali Klitschko gone? Where has Yulia Tymoshenko gone? When you look at the acting president and prime minister, have they actually gone to Donetsk? Or if they have, they've gone in the back of an APC. No one has gone to Donetsk and made a speech in Russian saying, we are all one Ukraine. I mean, this is politics 101, isn't it, Ivor?
It's also survival, though. I mean, I'm not sure if I was a leading politician from a regime that has been cleverly characterised by Russia and some people in eastern Ukraine as illegitimate, as semi-fascist, etc., I would actually be reluctant to climb on the back of a lorry and make a rabble-rousing speech in the centre of the cities of eastern Ukraine.
Mm. Yeah, so that moment may have gone now. I accept that, yeah.
There's a bit of realpolitik going on there. However, just to add, in my experience of working in post-Soviet societies, the quality of the politicians is generally very poor, because there is no tradition of a political class other than what's called the nomenklatura, the class that has grown up around the Communist Party, a class which is based on patronage, favours, and basically hereditary. So it's going to take a long time.
And that's actually one of the problems that the West is facing, because there's a recognition that the politicians in Ukraine have destroyed the country in many respects. Huge levels of corruption, certainly not a free media. I mean, we critique the Russian media, but Ukraine is not vastly better, it doesn't appear. And so the politicians in the West, on the one hand, they want to support what's going on in Ukraine and development and economic development, et cetera, On the other hand, they're left with a, you know, very bad set of cards, because then there isn't anybody credible and effective to support.
There has been an issue throughout this entire crisis about whether this is just Britain and America and France against Russia. And I think we saw at the weekend that actually throughout Europe, or certainly amongst certain people within Europe, there is, I think it's fair to say, a certain view on how Russia is.
Next country is Russia, la Russie.
Yeah, a few boos there greeting Russia's entry to Eurovision on Saturday night. There were many more when certain countries cast votes for them. Not only was the current crisis in Ukraine a source for the crowd's discontent, but the comments by one Russian MP, Vladimir Zhirinovsky, about Austria's winning entry, the drag act Conchita Wurst, Austria's bearded songstress, her victory was, according to Zhirinovsky, and I quote, the end of Europe. From the fading light of life, rise like a phoenix, out of the ashes seeking rather than vengeance, retribution. It's like a Bond theme, really, isn't it? Now, given Russia's own pop history, you'd think that they would perhaps be a bit more sort of a bit more tolerant, a bit more willing to listen to other types of music. Here's a sample. As I'm sure you all know, that was Tatu, Philip Kokorov, Sergei Zverev and Boris Moiseev. Just some of the most popular pop stars in Russia. And Zhenya Dormanty, I think it's fair to say that they appeal to a certain audience that perhaps our friend Vladimir Zhirinovsky and indeed Vladimir Putin might not be so familiar with.
I was so hoping you weren't going to come to me at this moment. I mean, seriously, what do you say? It's. I don't even know where to start. You know, put some other music on, please.
I'm not even going to pretend I have a clue what's going on. Are you saying that these are all gay icons?
All of them. Yes. Come on, this is Russian.
Gay Russian icons.
Gay Russian icons. Well, you couldn't tell that from the music, to be honest, but I haven't seen them perform.
Really? You can't tell that from the music?
Well, apart from the YMCA, I'm not very good at recognising gay songs, but that's because I'm a different generation when gay had a different connotation. They were very happy songs. But let me just add on a semi-serious point.
Yes.
I think that Russia is a very complex, a cliche here, but Russia is a complex society. It's a large society. We have an image of it based on some of the pretty unpleasant things it does. But I think what this discussion is suggesting, and I agree with it, that actually there's a lot more to Russia than the headlines. And there are developments in the society which perhaps go against the sort of direction that maybe Vladimir Putin is comfortable with.
Although, Zhenya, when we look at what's been happening in Ukraine over the past few weeks and the way that Europe has been described in Russian state media, there's been a lot of talk of, if Ukraine becomes European, then Ukraine is going to have gay marriage. And there's been a lot of talk of, we're against fascism and those Euro gays, was one quote I heard this morning.
I mean, yes, but here I agree with Ivo a little bit. We have to be very, very careful with this. There's absolutely no question that Russia has come out with repeated statements and has instituted new policies over the last few months that really are gay bashing or fining people who say anything positive about gays. I mean, so there's absolutely no question that what Russia is doing is wrong, racist in many cases, et cetera, et cetera. But we also have to remember that some of the language that we have in this country, some of the language you hear in the United States, isn't much better. And so to kind of back up where Eva was going, we shouldn't assume that it's a unitary set of beliefs or unitary system. It just isn't. I mean, we have some exceptionally terrifying language that in the United States we are legally required to allow people to say. And, you know, clearly the similar laws reside here in the UK as well and elsewhere in Europe. So we do have to be quite careful when we bash people for their language. We can be shocked about it. We can push back. It's slightly different when people are instituting as many a number of countries are doing, not just Russia, but a number in Africa as well. I think Uganda being one, some laws that punish such behaviour.
Zanya Dormady and Ivor Gabert, we'll leave it there. Thank you both very much for joining us on Midori House.
Vanuit London, dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
De Londres, essa é a Monocle 24.
Oi, London, this is Monocle 24.
Ot London, tu vai Monocle 24.
Fra London, dette Monocle 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Hollanda,
London. London으로부터
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London.
This is Monocle 24.
Lots more still to come in the second half of Midori House. We'll be in Montreal to catch up with our correspondent there. We'll also review the latest photography exhibitions here in London and meet the food writer who claims to know why the cupcake became the king of our current culinary preoccupations. But before all that, here's Suzanne Chislett with the news headlines.
Thank you, Steve. Russia's foreign ministry says the authorities in Kiev are showing a criminal lack of readiness for dialogue with separatists in the east of Ukraine. It's the first comment from Moscow since leaders in the region of Donetsk called on the Kremlin to consider absorbing it following Sunday's self-rule referendums. The European Union's announced more sanctions in response to the ballots. The Islamist militants who kidnapped more than 200 schoolgirls in Nigeria last month have released a video of around half of them wearing Islamic dress. Boko Haram's leader says he'll release them only if militant prisoners are freed in exchange. Aviation officials from around 40 countries are in Montreal for the highest level safety talks yet in response to the disappearance of Malaysia Airlines flight MH370. The meeting comes after the British satellite firm, which helped track the final known movements of the plane, offered to allow all flights fitted with its Inmarsat technology a free tracking service. Taliban militants in Afghanistan have launched a pre-declared summer offensive across the country. The violence is expected to continue as international combat troops complete their preparations to leave the country later this year. And India's marathon election is over, though the results won't be known for several more days. The ballot has taken 5 weeks to complete. Those are the latest headlines on Monocle 24.
Suzanne, thank you very much indeed. You're listening to Midori House with me, Steve Bloomfield, at 18:32 here in London, 14:32 in Sao Paulo and Rio. Now, quinoa, Honeycrisp apples, kale, pomegranate seeds. I would say I'm getting hungry just saying those, but frankly, I'm not, because really, pomegranate seeds. Anyway, these are some of the key players in the biggest foodie fads of recent years. But why do some foods assume the cookery crown so confidently at one moment, only for it to slip from grace the next? In his new book, The Tastemakers, Why We're Crazy for Cupcakes and Fed Up with Fondue and with Alliteration, the author David Sachs explains why the lazy Susan of our culinary preoccupations keeps on turning. He spoke a short while ago to our very own Daphne Denis.
I decided to write the book because I was doing journalism and writing stories for Business Week magazine in the United States around the food industry and sort of the back end of the food industry. And I kept bumping up against the idea that, you know, taste wasn't something that was so individual. Taste was actually made. And that these food trends, which is really, you know, our collective tastes, where our appetite is as a society, were not something that we all just happened upon. There were various forces and people that I call tastemakers working all along the way to sort of drive us in a particular direction.
It's interesting because when I saw the pitch of your book, I thought of it as a very New York book or maybe North American book, because it's something very sort of specific to the American culture to have those trends, the cronut, the cupcake, the chia seeds. I'm not saying that we don't have those in Europe. I'm saying that in the US and perhaps in Canada as well, it's so much more.
Yeah, and there's this very specific reason why that is. You know, North American culture is an immigrant culture. It's a mishmash culture. There is no one dominant culinary force. In Japan, in France, in Spain, in Colombia, in Argentina, where I used to live, you know, there is a refined, defined native cuisine. And that really dominates most menus that you find, whether it's in big cities or small towns. I remember when I first moved to Buenos Aires, a friend of mine, a fellow North American journalist said, you know, I said, why is every menu the same? And he's like, you know, an Argentinian doesn't want to eat something that he hasn't eaten before. Now that's changed and is changing with increased globalization and exposure to ideas, to trends that come through the internet a lot, as well as, you know, popular TV shows. But in North America, it's still much more dominant because we don't have this codified way of eating. We're always looking for what's new, what's the next influence, what's our next taste. And it provides this very fertile environment for trends to grow and blossom.
So you divide your book in different trends. There's the cultural trend, the agricultural trend, the chef trend, and the health trend. But if you look at it with the bigger picture, where do these trends come from? How do they get created and how do they turn into something that people are following and sort of need to know about?
I think from a 10,000 foot level, trends that take off, successful food trends, they tend to reflect something greater in the society. They tend to meet a need that we have, whether that's a need for comfort and nostalgia, whether that's a need for sort of excitement and innovation, or for a feeling of reward and decadence, or this craving of sort of health, or at least the appearance of health. And so they come from a variety of different directions. I mean, they come from all directions, really. The most obvious and the one that I think is most popular and that we can see most directly is kind of chef-driven food trends. Some, you know, individual working in their kitchen creates something and that thing resonates with eaters, but also with the media who popularize it, and other chefs start emulating it and cooking their own versions of it or their own takes on it. And it moves down the food chain until suddenly a couple years later, you're eating, you know, sriracha flavored Doritos or some sort of, you know, pulled pork sandwich at McDonald's. And so that's a very obvious one. The health and diet trends, a very different set of things. They're often taken from some item of research, some study that says, you know, I don't know, fishermen in Okinawa live, you know, X years longer than most people in the rest of the world. And so we sort of go, oh, well, what are they eating? Well, they eat a lot of salmon. Well, what's in salmon? Omega-3s. Well, it's got to be omega-3s. And then all of a sudden, you know, omega-3 fortified orange juice, omega-3 fortified sriracha flavored Doritos. And then the cultural trend, which is something like the cupcake, this item that, you know, people knew from their childhood was sort of a birthday party treat. And because of its cameo appearance in Sex and the City in one clip from one episode in 2000, it suddenly gets this whole new association with it. Oh, cupcakes aren't for children anymore. They're for single, sexy women who wear, you know, $500 pairs of heels. And it took off not on the basis of someone inventing the cupcake or even reinventing the cupcake, but just it got a cultural kind of cachet tagged onto it. Those are very powerful trends because they really just use a food item to represent something much larger.
I'm interested in the idea of longevity that you were talking about just earlier. When you look at sort of the chef-driven trends, for instance, when you look at someone like David Chang, who is featured in your book, the man who created Momofuku, for instance, isn't it a bit daunting, a bit nerve-wracking for someone like that to have been the creator of such a big, impactful trend in the way that you present food, etc., and to have to stay relevant when everyone's copied you and you're sort of becoming mainstream all of a sudden?
Yeah, I mean, I think the analogy to draw is with a musician, right? Who does something and creates an album that really is revolutionary and changes, you know, the music business, or changes as introduces a trend in a style of music. Think Bob Dylan, you know, when he really took off in his early folk albums. All of a sudden, you see that everywhere around you, people are emulating what you're doing, whether it's the exact same dishes, you know, pork belly, braised sort of Chinese style pork belly buns, or the different influences that you're using, putting Korean ingredients and kimchi and South Asian ingredients in with sort of North American style comfort food, the types of decor, the way that you run your restaurant. It is daunting. And David Chang said that it's very weird to go into a restaurant in a city that you've never been to with someone who never worked for you and see sort of that influence right there, you know, the exact same menu. And so it's easy to get caught up in it. And so you could see sort of two directions where this happens with chefs. They fully embrace the celebrity aspect and, you know, they parlay it off into television shows and to their lines of cookware and, you know, really just make the most of it in terms of profits. But, you know, they're not in the kitchen. They don't sort of innovate. And so they were a trendsetter for a period of time, and that trend has some influence, but they really then become, quote unquote, a brand, which is probably one of the more nauseating ways to refer to human beings. And the other direction is, you know, they can go the Bob Dylan route, which is to say, well, I did that, but, you know, to heck with you. I'm going to keep innovating and I'm going to just cook and do what I do. And I'm not going to chase what I did. I'm going to keep trying to make new tastes and new flavors.
That was David Sacks, author of The Tastemakers, Why We're Crazy for Cupcakes and Fed Up with Fondue, speaking to Daphne Denis. Up next, we'll check in with one of our correspondents around the world. Where will it be? Well, if you were listening earlier, you'd know. But if you weren't, don't worry, you'll find out after this.
Should cities ban the car? Can we make truly sustainable metropolises? What happens if neighbourhoods lose their corner shops? How do you put a stop to suburban decay? Do children belong in big bad capitals? Can Detroit be saved? Can Sydney become a cycle capital? Can we learn to love concrete? And are rich cities always boring? If you want the answers to the big questions facing our cities, you need to tune in to The Urbanist, Monocle 24 Radio's weekly show about the cities we live in. Expect global reports, great interviews, passionate debate, and some surprises too, because drag star taxi drivers, love motel owners, and retail rebels also get their say. Presented by me, Andrew Tuck, The Urbanist premieres every Thursday at 1900 hours London time, and you can also download it from monocle.com or iTunes.
You're listening to Midori House, 1841 here in London. It's 1341 on the east coast of America, and we're going to head a little bit further north from the US to Montreal, where our correspondent there, Patrick Pittman, is standing by. Patrick, welcome to Midori House. I believe you're incredibly excited about the enormously successful local team, sporting team that are playing tonight, that are going to bring glory to Montreal in a sport that I believe people up there are interested in, hockey.
Go the local sporting team, absolutely. But the only thing you can see in Montreal at the moment is flags for the Habs, the Montreal Canadiens. They're in the playoffs, they're behind against Boston, but it's pretty much the only thing anybody's talking about in this town right now.
And as someone who was formerly our Melbourne correspondent, have you found it quite easy to get back into hockey?
Well, you know, it's one of those sports that's very strange to watch on the television and from far away. And really, it only makes sense when you're in a city that actually cares about it and you get a sense of the passion. And when you get out into the arena as well, it's a much easier sport to follow in real life.
Okay, let's talk about some more serious things that no one else in Montreal is actually talking about, but people outside Montreal might be interested in. The Charbonneau Commission. Tell us about this and why it's important.
Okay, so for the past couple of years, the Charbonneau Commission's been running an investigation into corruption and collusion between Montreal's, what you'd call its construction industry, euphemistically, and the public service. And it's been a bit of a constant soap opera, lots of mad testimony of mafia kingpins stuffing money into socks, that kind of thing. It's claimed the scalps of two mayors so far as well.
So it's, as you say, this isn't sort of your normal everyday corruption, which involves, you know, a little backhander here or there or allegations. I mean, as you say, it's, you know, it's taken out two mayors. It is stuffing money into socks. What's the final act, it seems, of this commission is about to hit us. Where is it going before it ends?
Well, it seems that Justice Charbonneau, she's doing what people always do when you set them free on these things. She's following the money. And before she finishes up, she's planning to meet with every provincial party leader and premier who's held office in the last almost two decades. And it seems she's got a lot of questions to ask about fundraising.
Do we have any indication of what she might uncover at the end. Are there certain politicians who have reason to be running scared at the moment?
Well, look, what you have to understand about Montreal and Quebec politics is everybody has a reason to be running scared. This stuff is endemic. There were a lot of rumours sort of circling around during the last election campaign, even directly relating to the former Premier Pauline Marois. And there was some talk that maybe the election was called early due to this coming. But, you know, it's all gossip, but there's something coming anyway.
OK, well, we'll keep an eye on that. More politics of a different nature. There's been issues between the Canadian government in Ottawa and also Canada's First Nations people over education reform. Tell us a bit more about that.
Well, this was actually, I was surprised to see this taking up the full front page of the National Daily, the Globe and Mail the other day. This is bigger news than I expected it to be in some ways. But basically, the federal government has been looking to implement substantial reforms for on-reservation education where, you know, there are serious problems. A couple of years ago, only 40% of children were actually graduating from high school if they were being educated on the reserves. So the government had been looking to invest about $2 billion directly into implementing some standards there and those kinds of things. And that had the support of the chief of the Association of First Nations, Sean Atlio, but it seems he didn't really have the support of many of the chiefs of the various First Nations around the country who were really angry at him going along with Ottawa. And he's actually had to resign this week.
And finally, let's head back to Quebec. And there's a temporary foreign worker program in Canada, and Quebec wants a bit of an exemption from this moratorium on this program. And it's brought out some rather sort of fruity language from the boss of McDonald's.
Yes, indeed. Can we use that?
Yeah, you can. Go on, go for it.
Okay, good. So basically, in Western Canada, there were some rumours that McDonald's was using temporary foreign worker provisions to hire immigrant labour over locals. The CEO of McDonald's Canada called those allegations bullshit, which is always nice to hear. But it did cause the federal government to put a moratorium on food companies using these provisions. Quebec, though, is asking for an exemption from this, saying that that's going to cause a lot of stress for the restaurant industry here. You know, as with all of these things, you know, politicians, when issues about migration come up, everybody jumps in with something. So there's a lot of back and forth on this right now.
Indeed. Patrick Pittman in Montreal, thank you very much indeed. And do pass on our good luck to the Habs for tonight. We are going to stay in Montreal because, you know, why not? Here's some music. It's Jealous by local band Chromeo. Jealous by Chromeo there from the great city of Montreal. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. We've got a bit of photography for you next. We're coming towards the end of the show. We're getting there steadily, slowly, but don't worry. We have one more final treat for you. It's our daily review, and today it's photography. A short while ago, I spoke to Sue Steward, the photography critic for London's Evening Standard newspaper, about the very best new exhibitions here in London. First of all, let's talk about a new exhibition opening at Somerset House, the World Photography Organization Awards exhibition, rather snappily titled.
Exactly. WPO, we call it.
Exactly, the WPO. Tell us a bit about this exhibition, and then we'll talk about some of the work in particular.
Okay, well, this has been going since 2008, and it started off in Cannes. It was shown in Cannes till 2011, and it's gradually grown and expanded, I mean exponentially actually. And 2014, it's had 140,000 entries from 166 countries.
And how does it hang together as an exhibition, given how diverse both the photographers and the subjects actually are?
Physically, they've taken it into two categories, the East and West Wing of Somerset House. The professional category has 14 categories within it. So from that, you have quite serious documentary, current issues and so on, contemporary lifestyles, sport, arts, culture. So you've got all that in one place, but there are small rooms in the Somerset House, so it's really perfect for it.
Then on the east wing are all the smaller groups. For instance, the Open is just 10 different people, each presenting one image. The youth one is a very big one in a bigger room. And they actually I find that the youth and the student focus are just as good and as interesting as the ones in the others, which are more professional.
Let's talk about one of the most interesting winners, Sara Naomi Levkovic, and her series, Shane and Maggie, looks at domestic violence.
Yeah, this is a very interesting story, actually. And I first saw it in the New York Times. And what she did was, she was beyond student. She was a sort of documentary photographer, a young woman who just got to know the family because she saw in a shop in a mall, she saw this guy with a big tattoo across his neck saying, "My girl." And he was holding a little girl in his arms. And she just got to talk to him and got to know the family and went and sort of stayed with them quite a lot and became very close to them. But then gradually realised that the violence was going on between him and the wife. And in these photographs, some of them are pretty scary.
They really are.
Really.
I mean, even the first photo that it opens on, of Maggie sat down on the stoop with her two blonde kids next to her, it's in the sun, and Shane sort of leaning over, it looks like he's going for a kiss. It looks quite sweet. But then actually, when you see how these photos develop, and some of them include him striking her, there's a photo of him being arrested as well by police. You then go back to that original shot and there's a lot more menace to it, isn't
there? Wonder what is going on behind it. I mean, that first one, exactly. And the one where he's just hit her in the kitchen, in the corner, the little girl who's probably less than two is standing there crying behind. There's a great controversy about this. A lot of people felt it should be published in something like the New York Times. But the interesting thing is that, you know, we see reconstructions on TV all the time of those kind of scenes, but we never see the real thing. And I think it's very, very important that she won it and she did the overall prize.
Let's talk about Steve Curry and his show on Afghanistan, which is at the Huxley Gallery in Swallow Street at W1. Now, some people might well recognise The Girl with Green Eyes, which was on the cover of National Geographic back in 1985 and is exactly as it's described.
Yes.
But he's got an astonishing range of photos from Afghanistan over the past 20 or 30 years, hasn't he?
Yes. I mean, he first went there in 1978, so he moved in just around the time of the Russian situation in Afghanistan. And he was a photojournalist all the time, but also worked for National Geographic. So he has a sort of softness side to him and a tenderness and goes for the beauty of things rather than a kind of raw, open, brutal war photography. And what he did was he was always interested in the people. And this is how I found this girl who was completely anonymous, a sort of country girl. And it's an amazing photograph. In fact, to just tell you the end story of that, you probably know this, but he did track her down last year and she was found. She's got a family and she lives in the countryside and he did find her. I can't actually remember her name, but it was quite an extraordinary thing.
It's an incredibly striking photo. And there's a number of others here that are certainly in no way as famous, but are equally striking.
It's a real
mixture, isn't it? And it's the profiles as well. So, I mean, even the portraits, rather, woman in canary burqa, which is exactly how it sounds.
Exactly, yes.
And she's, again, this sort of very striking blue background as well. There's a lot of interesting portraits, aren't there?
The girl picking poppies, I think that's very interesting because she comes over, she's probably about 10, standing there picking these beautiful flowers, regardless of what they actually mean and their implication. And he just has this sense of colour all the way through his work. The mountain scenes he just did a lot of work in the landscapes and in the mountains. And they're very sculptural forms, and he just goes in and creates works on that kind of sculptural shape of the mountains. But, you know, at the same time, he's also got Taliban. He's got the fighters out there in the cars and standing with the AK-7s and so on. So he's done that mixture, but I find it interesting because it's never like a Simon Norfolk, which is going in originally, was going in as a war photographer, or Tim Hetherington. But both of those people have moved back from the kind of the real action of war into much softer but implying.
I particularly like the teeth maker in Kandahar, who is actually a teeth maker.
Who
sat there.
Exactly. But the other one is the Afghan photographer.
Yes.
Got the Afghan camera.
It's a brilliant camera.
It's fantastic. And we had it here last year in Derby at the Format Photo Festival. They brought it over and we're using it. And we're having photos taken on this amazing box.
Fantastic. Let's move from Afghanistan to Iran. Burnt Generation, a contemporary Iranian photography, also at Somerset House. Yes. And this is work by a number of different photographers in Iran. Some are very artistic and some are looking at everyday life. So there's a picture of of a girl with a birthday cake in front of her. There's also some very sort of stylized ones out on a moor. It's trying to show sort of the lots of different sides of this country, isn't it?
Yes, this is eight different Iranian women. This is eight women who've done photography. Mostly they're working inside. They're working in the kind of hidden, concealed lifestyle. But a lot of them, like you say, there's a sort of isolation in this a lot of the time. There are women working. The one you talked about sitting there with the birthday cake, symbolically, is she's sitting there almost trapped. She's got a balcony outside with railings, and then she's got a building outside. And it looks like she's trapped. And this represents, to a great extent, the lifestyle of a lot of those young women.
She's not looking happy about her birthday cake in front of her.
She's not at all. Her lifestyle is very frustrating, and she lives in the same building as other people, but they rarely see each other. But there's a lot of metaphor and conceptual art in this, which I find extremely interesting. And I have to mention that Fariba Farshad, who is Iranian herself, but who lives and works in Somerset House, is her office. She brought this all in, and she's put together an exhibition which I think is absolutely stunning, because we're very unfamiliar with what's going on in that world. There's a lot of cliches, but there's some extremely interesting projects here.
And how many of these photographers would be able to show their work in Iran?
Well, some of these obviously wouldn't. There's one which is reinventing a scene where a body is being pulled out of the water, and this is in a kind of on the edge of a beach, and this is somebody who's obviously been killed or tortured. Now, something like that would get them into trouble, I'm sure. Otherwise, I do know a photographer who was actually in prison because some of her work was showing her hair without the burqa on or without the hijab. But, I mean, there are other things which are really interesting, which are like still lifes. There's one which is all kind of military equipment hanging in a carrier bag in the kitchen and done as a still life. But all these pieces of equipment are there inside it, and they're treated in a domestic space as a sort of domestic object, a still life. And it's very beautiful. But again, you know, it's saying something else.
That was Sue Stewart, photography critic for London's Evening Standard newspaper, speaking to me a little before we came on air. And that ends today's Midori House. My thanks in particular to our special guests, Zainia Dormandy and Ivor Gaber. The show was produced by Thomas Lewis, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Carlotta Ribello. Our studio manager was Alex Funnell. Next up, after the news, is Culture with Robert Bound. This week, Rob hosts a crime special. Yes, it even includes a bit of Crime Watch. If you're not a UK viewer, you're in for a treat. Then, of course, 2200, it's the Monocle Daily, so lots more to come tonight. Midori House is back at the same time tomorrow, 1800 in London, 1300 in New York. That's also with me as well. But for now, thank you very much for listening. I'm Steve Bloomfield. Goodbye.
Rolex is responsible for several landmark innovations in watchmaking, including the Oyster, the first waterproof wristwatch, and the perpetual rotor self-winding mechanism. Crafted from the finest raw materials and assembled with scrupulous attention to detail, Oyster perpetual watches benefit from Rolex's cutting-edge technology and extensive expertise. Epitomizing the values that have made the brand world famous, Oyster perpetual watches symbolize a way of life, a benchmark for style.